Welcome to News in Context. I'm Gina Valeria. In this episode, we explore the recent history of women's sports, particularly basketball, in college and professionally, including in the 90s, when the first women's professional league was established, the American Basketball League, or ABL, followed closely by the WNBA. With increased attention and interest on women's college basketball, thanks to players like Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, and Cameron Brink, and an acknowledgement of the high level of play and skill, the hope is that women's basketball, soccer, and other sports will get the attention and fan base they've deserved for years. But women's sports have been in the spotlight before. How is this moment similar and different to what we've seen in the past? My guest is Sarah Fields, professor of communication at the University of Colorado Denver and president of the North American Society for Sport History. I have had an interest in the ABL and in women's basketball. I played from an early age all through high school, couldn't have played Division I and wanted to go to UCLA, so I had to say goodbye to basketball at that point, or at least, you know, playing on it. And then in grad school, I did a little master's project on the WNBA and ABL because it was happening right then. And I've always wondered sort of what really went down and had my thoughts. So now that we're here in this moment with, you know, women's basketball really getting some attention, more attention, the March Madness for women being of more interest really than the men's March Madness, the retirement of Tara Vanderveer, I just thought it would be a good moment to explore it again. So let's start with your orientation to basketball. You mentioned you always love to talk about basketball, as do I. What brings you to basketball is something you really enjoy.
So I started playing organized basketball when I was about 12, and I was living in Denmark, and they didn't have enough girls for the ninth grade team for the two tournaments they played, so I got to play on that team. And I was neither big nor talented, but I was a warm body, so they let me on the team. And my dad always loved basketball, so I grew up watching it with him and playing at parks. And when I was 10, we bought a house where we could put a hoop in the backyard, and we played every night until I went away to college. I did play high school ball. I, too, wasn't good enough to play D1 ball, so I moved to intramurals as a college student. And then my peak as a player came when I was in law school, and my basketball team, we played 3-on-3 tournaments. And we won the National Intramural Recreation, says NERSA, whatever it was. So, you know, we spent a long weekend in Dallas. We got to play on the old Reunion Arena floor for the championship, got to watch a professional game. And at that point, there was a guy, he was from St. Louis, and he was in the league. And he was a little older than we are, but everybody knew who he was. And he actually showed up because his team was playing. And so he watched us in the finals and got us behind the bench during his game. And yeah, it was all super fun. And since then, I've just, you know, kind of retired from the game, but I shoot hoops occasionally. But I was a junkie when the ABL, I was in grad school studying sports when the ABL started in the 1996 kind of run up to the Olympics leading to those leagues. So in 97, I saw a couple of ABL games and a couple of WNBA games, and I would go to them periodically for as long as the ABL lasted. Remain a fan, and I have issues with the NCAA as an organization, and I've tried really hard to divorce myself from college sport, but I have a degree from the University of Iowa, and my dad lives in Iowa City now, so I got completely sucked back into the last 2 years of Iowa mania and watched it all voraciously.
I love that. It's the Godfather 3 line. Every time I try to step out, they pull me back in.
Precisely.
So I was also in grad school in 96, 97, not studying sports, but interested. Let's start with the NCAA then, because you've mentioned it, and its orientation to women's sports and, if appropriate, women's basketball.
Historically, the NCAA has ignored and hated women's sports. They fought hard. I mean, they simply refused to tolerate it for decades. They didn't begin, you know, supervising it, as you know, until the early 80s. And that was really only in response to the AIAW having success and people paying attention to those games. The AIAW had tried to work with the NCAA, and it never quite worked, mostly because the NCAA just said, no, we're the boys. They filed, you know, various lawsuits and did everything they could not to comply with Title IX. And then when it turned out they had to, they did so reluctantly and begrudgingly. And then they just screwed the women over and over and over and are still doing it. I mean, seriously, a 9-inch difference in a 3-point line? How is that humanly possible? And do we really believe that they would have said to the guys, oh, yeah, we didn't notice. Are you good with it?
It's always been a little ridiculous to me. I remember as a and this isn't the NCAA, but how women are treated inside sports or have been treated. I hope it's getting better. But I remember we played when I was a child, a 10-year-old, with the regulation ball. And then at some point when I was 12, they decided that young kids and young girls in particular should have smaller. And so I had to actually transition to a smaller basketball. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a little 12-year-old being very indignant about what is going on here and very unhappy.
Yeah, I have a conspiracy theory about that. They didn't change the ball for no reason. It makes it almost impossible for men and women to play together.
Whoa. Yeah.
I mean, when you play pickup ball co-ed, you always play with a men's ball because the men won't play with a women's ball.
Yeah.
And then they say, oh, well, the women can't shoot because it's a different ball.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Hey, I'm going to get on board with that because it's the, yeah, it just seems very ridiculous. And there was an intentional and deliberate choice to do this.
Yeah. We can talk about the smaller hands, blah, blah, blah. No, it was about making sure there was no distinction.
That is really interesting. So the NCAA lives in our systemic soup. Of, you know, oh no, women, you're too delicate to, I've never been a delicate person, but women, you're too delicate to do this, oh God, oh no.
The NCAA's treatment of the men's and women's tournaments have been radically different since the beginning, right down to, you know, you can't use the March Madness until this year. And then, of course, Sedona Price's lovely video from 2 years ago showing the weight room. Here's a yoga mat and a dumbbell. Good luck.
Yeah, I appreciated that moment so much. And I'm so thankful for social media in that context because that kind of thing would never have gotten attention until we had visual social media that could show people, you know, what's going on.
Precisely.
And I wonder if even the ABL today would have gotten a fairer shake because they could have gotten outside the media monolith.
I think that was a factor. It seems abundantly clear from the history of professional sport and sport in this country that you can't succeed financially until you can get the media deals. How is baseball paying such exorbitant salaries when you look at the stands and there are 7 people there? I live in Denver and because I'm over 55, the day of, I can get a ticket to the bleacher section for $1. And I've never had a problem doing so after the first month of play. But the media deals, it's the money, it's the media. And when the ABL shows up originally, and it looks like it's going to be the only one, and people start to get excited, and then the NBA announces the WNBA, and they can use their leverage. I'm not going to accuse them of antitrust violation without more evidence, but I have no doubt that it was part of the discussion points in their media relations.
What I remember, and again, yeah, I think we have to tread carefully. I believe a lawsuit was considered, the ABL owners considered filing a lawsuit. I'm not sure that ever did happen, but I do remember very distinctly, I look back at like the writings and the history and some of it acknowledges it, but I remember the ABL started and there was such excitement and all the major college players signed with the ABL or 90+% of them. And then the WNBA came out later and it almost did feel like it was a response, like that it wasn't going to be announced and how clearly the distinction became in the elite players choosing the ABL. For the reasons we just talked about, I would love to for you to talk to me about your recollections and sort of what you remember in that moment, and then as a sports historian, how you put that in context.
Yeah, and this actually ties back to Tara Vanderveer. So in the 92 Olympics, when the women didn't win the gold medal because the women had no professional opportunities, so they'd, you know, finish up their college days, and if they went to Europe, great. And then it turns out that you couldn't put together a team of women who hadn't been really actively playing and have them win the gold medal. And so the USOC came up with the idea of let's have a year-long tour. And they took the best players, and Tara Vanderveer takes that year leave of absence from Stanford to coach them, which I would add actually had an impact on her career at Stanford because she loses a whole year there, which impacts recruiting. And, you know, maybe she wins another championship. I read somewhere that she thought it took that it set the program back 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
By her being gone.
Yeah.
Nothing should diminish from her collegiate career. She was an amazing coach. But she voluntarily left that, which most coaches wouldn't. And she coaches these women who are paid enough to take a year out of their lives and play. They win every game. We start paying attention. We get excited. They make the run in the Olympics, which I think is impressive because of how much pressure they were under. If they had not won gold, it would have been the end of this experiment. They win gold. We're all excited. All but two of them say they're going to sign with the ABL, Rebecca Lobo and Cheryl Swoops. And Rebecca Lobo, who, great college player, probably shouldn't have been on the Olympic team, but she was. And Cheryl Swoops is pregnant, so she's not going to play that first season. So she was never going to play in the ABL because the timing really didn't work. The hope was she could come in at the end of the WNBA first season, as I recall, but she was the poster child. Pregnant Cheryl Swoops on the cover of like Sports Illustrated for Women in her WNBA uniform, which is establishing, you know, all the heteronormativity and everything else that becomes ironic over time. Whereas the ABL has, it feels like, literally everybody else. It turns out they don't have everybody else. There are some really good players who play in that WNBA. I'm thinking of Cynthia Cooper and the folks on that Houston Comets team those first few years, Kim Perrin. That was an amazing team. But the ABL had amazing players, and they played during basketball season. They played a full-length season. It wasn't this abbreviated thing. But they didn't play in the giant NBA arenas. Like, I went and saw the at the time, the Cleveland Rockers up in the, and they played in the Cavaliers Arena. Whereas when I went to watch the ABL team in, I think it was Long Beach, I think they were playing in the Long Beach State Arena. They were not playing in the Los Angeles Coliseum or what the Staples Center or anything like that. From the very beginning, they're set up. And then the structures, as I recall, were also different. Like, the players in the ABL had a piece of the league. That's a big component. If you have some sort of ownership vestment or a path to ownership, that changes your relationship.
Right, right.
And if that's true, then it also undermines the NBA, who does not want that. You know, they've always enjoyed being owned by really wealthy people.
Right, really wealthy people and really wealthy white men. And, you know, as a professor, I try to be careful because so many times, like, oh, that's negative. And it's like, it's not negative in a vacuum. It's just the fact that when anything is dominant, it can become problematic. And in this case, white men just happen to be the people who are calling the shots at the NBA, and that can have an impact on a woman's experience and a woman's opportunities.
And I would be willing to bet that if we were to go back and look at the structure of the NBA when the WNBA was announced, that it was all white male owners at that time, and that it was probably overwhelmingly white male leadership in the league office.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know the WNBA was Val Ackerman, the first WNBA commissioner.
Yes.
But I don't know what the gender of the rest of the staff was, but they were very much, I mean, no league starts off strong. You have to have support from somewhere. And their support came from the NBA. And that was predominantly led by white guys.
Right, exactly. I remember hearing in 96, 97, that the NBA actually went to ESPN and said, if you play the ABL, we will pull the NBA and go somewhere else. And I don't know if that's true.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I vaguely think I heard those rumors as well, but I don't know. And it may have been, my friends and I were all super gung-ho about the ABL, and we had our concerns about the WNBA, although it was still, you know, we went to games and we still talked about them and we still watched.
Sure.
But we were definitely looking for conspiracies.
Yeah.
For the ABL's failure, when in reality, the ABL was probably always, I mean, leagues fail constantly when they first start. Look at how many iterations it's taken for women's professional soccer to finally have something that looks quasi-stable.
Yeah.
And even the MLS, that's taken forever to really be viable. I'm surprised it didn't fail more often, although there were previous men's soccer programs that failed.
Yeah, exactly.
And I still like to remind my students that the, was it the 1979 NBA finals that were tape delayed?
Were they really?
Yeah. So it took a long time for the NBA to matter too.
Right. And there was another men's league, I think it was the ABL in the 60s that failed.
Yes. And some of those teams merged into the NBA somewhere in the 70s.
So the ABL in the mid-90s announces first and says, we're going to treat these players like players, you know, not like women who are playing this sport. You know, regulation size ball, full season, season in the right place in the year. And we saw initially that most of the top players went to the ABL. But then 1 year later, I was reading an article, the WNBA was getting the signings more often than the ABL. And I don't know what happened in that year on the ABL side. What happened in that first year of the ABL? There was, of course, the NBA component, but there was also the component of an organization trying to get itself off the ground.
My recollection was that there were some ownership instability even after that first season. And that's, again, not shocking because this is really common in all new professional leagues. And the downside of not having established super wealthy ownership is they can't afford to lose lots and lots of money for very long. Even at the time when I remember thinking, if the WNBA really had the NBA's backing, it seemed like a safer bet because of the established NBA, because of their money. And at the time when they were originally set up, almost all the WNBA franchise were owned by an NBA franchise or the same ownership group. And that wouldn't change for a little while. And that gave it at least the appearance of reliability that the ABL didn't necessarily have.
You're listening to News in Context. I'm Gina Valeria. We're talking with sports historian Sarah Fields about women's professional basketball and the treatment of women's sports over the past few decades.
Plus, the WNBA had the advantage of the NBA connection. I remember the ads they ran during the NBA finals in 96, 97. And it was like, we got next. And the NBA could pay for all of that. It drummed up excitement. One of the games that I saw in Cleveland, Cheryl Miller, I think, was still coaching the Phoenix Suns. And that game was sold out. And it was an amazing dynamic experience because, you know, it's in what was then, I think, Gund Arena. And the whole thing was really incredibly cool and intense. And I remember comparing that to one of my ABL games in Long Beach, which was in a, you know, kind of a dark gym. And the quality was great of play, but the experience was different. ABL felt a little more like a college game, in part because of the setting. Ever remember watching ABL games on TV? They must have been televised somewhere, but I don't remember it. I only remember the games that I went to.
I think they were televised on Fox Sports Net and BET.
Okay.
But I don't think Fox Sports Net wasn't what it is today, right?
Right.
It was also fledgling.
Yeah, I'm sure I didn't have that on my rural Iowa cable station.
Exactly.
Pretty sure I had BET, but yeah, I don't remember watching them. And I do remember the WNBA getting more network airtime.
Yeah.
And I'm going to include ESPN as the network, even though they were separate from ABC at that point.
So the ABL folded and there was never, I couldn't find any way that a lawsuit was ever filed on illegal business practices. So we'll never really know on paper what went down.
So I had a graduate student when I was teaching at Ohio State University, Valerie Still, who was a major player. I think she was like she won some MVPs with the ABL.
I think she did, yeah.
She was an amazing player. We had some conversations and she was not a fan of the WNBA. And she wrote like an op-ed column about being basically blacklisted by the WNBA because of her role in the ABL. And I don't think she ever did play in the WNBA despite being this amazing, I mean, she won 3 championships with the ABL.
I did read, and it's not just Valerie Still, it was a few players mentioned that they sat the bench in the WNBA, including Kate Starbird. The article didn't go and explicitly say anything, but it was hinting at that by saying players who left the ABL before it folded were getting to play, but players who left the ABL after the fold were bench warmers.
Yeah, if the ABL is gone, what do you care? And No, we're still people. We're still petty. We still worry about those other things. And it's in the end, it's more about money than it is about winning. And those two things do not always equate.
Right, right. I saw this quote from Brian Agler, who was the GM and head coach of the Quest. But he says the longevity of the NBA can be attributed to many facts, including they started off slower. They created the game in the summer so players could go to Europe, play and make more money. That ended up working for the long term. And then, of course, a lot of the women are saying, gosh, now we have to go back into this thing where we're half here, half there, can't settle down. You know, so whereas this, some people were like, oh, this is great. You can play year round. And the women are like, actually, no, we'd like to just be in one place. So is an interesting sort of the talking points around the folding and the.
Yeah. And it does a good job. I mean, again, in my conspiracy theorist approach, all of this minimizes the women's experience. They get paid less because it's a shorter season. We can all equate with that. On the other hand, being an athlete is a year-round experience, but being an athlete doesn't mean you should play year-round. I mean, every sports med doc will tell you that playing year-round is awful for you, especially as you age. And then when we factor in the politics that we saw with the risks of, you know, playing in Russia that Brittany Griner faced, that puts a whole nother spin on it.
Absolutely. So the ABL happened. It didn't last long, but it left this amazing legacy. I read one article discussing the activism that probably the WNBA would not have tolerated. This article attributed social justice activism to the ABL and women from the ABL being able to find their voices and then carry that into the WNBA. Also, this idea of working to legitimize women's sports along with women's soccer, you know, pointing out that they have better record and they have more viewers. And so there are women's athletes all around have been working hard to just say, hey, look, we're athletes and the play is great. So now we're in this moment where we've got your Iowa star, Caitlin Clark, and we've got all these other stars. I mean, there were multiple people in the tournament this year and last year and who are legitimate stars, legitimate, strong, solid basketball players. And that's always been true, but now the lens is being focused there.
I am hopeful that we'll see more interest in women's sport, both at the college and professional level. I think we are making progress in convincing viewers and fans that the women's game is an excellent product across the board. I get dragged back because we've had these moments before with great viewership and great numbers, and then something happens. Often the media changes focus. There were several articles recently about how there were really good viewership of the Cheryl Miller years, particularly. And then they switched and it went off of network TV and it went on to ESPN before ESPN is what it is today. Like one of the very first women's professional soccer leagues ridiculously televised their game on a network called PAX. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah. Vaguely.
Yeah. So it was a predominantly religious content. And so often you got things like Touched by an Angel. It was not if you were channel surfing for sports where you would ever go. And it wasn't in a lot of cable packages either, because it was not particularly common. It's like, well, that's not the best place to put it. And as soon as we start doing that, as soon as we pull it off the easy to access airways, whatever we want to call it today, then people don't watch. And so that is my big fear, is that whether through malevolence or incompetence or the patriarchy, that suddenly we will absolutely be able to see every game on our Big Ten SEC apps on our phone, but nothing will be televised that you could watch in a bar. It's happened before. And so my fear is that. But the biggest difference now, I think, is this long-term effects of Title IX in terms of generations of girls who, and now women, some of whom are in positions of power and authority, who grew up playing sports. And it wasn't just watching with their dads and playing in the backyard. It was playing on teams. And those teams got more and more competitive as the years went on. Caitlin Clark wouldn't have been Caitlin Clark if she was our age, because she wouldn't have had those same experiences.
Right.
And in fact, there's this really, I think it's the early 80s, there was a lawsuit by a girl, I'm blanking on her name, but I have it, it's hidden in one of my books. She wants to play on a boys' basketball team in like the eighth grade because she says the girls' team just isn't good enough. And she's played in boys' tournaments, she can hold her own, and it's irritating the other parents because she's winning MVP awards, all of that. She's like the Caitlin Clark of her little local era. But instead of allowing her to play, they say, no, you got to play on the girls' team, which practices once a week and, you know, plays games every other week, whatever. It's a totally different experience. So she sues, and the case goes all the way up to the circuit judge, and it's John Paul Stevens, one of the more liberal justices ever on the court. And Stevens rules that because they have a separate team from girls, she must play on it and raise the level of play for the group. So his ruling basically protects girls as a class while harming this one girl as an individual. And so she doesn't get to advance in the same way. Now the girls' teams are competitive. I mean, Caitlin Clark has played against boys when she was little, but the girls' teams, the travel teams, I mean, all those young women in this tournament who played together on U19 and U21 teams, it's a remarkable experience that didn't exist back in the day. And so I think the expectation of these women is higher. I tried out for the soccer team at my... I went to the first day of tryouts and then saw how good they were and walked away and went to intramurals for soccer. And at that point in time, there was like 2 inches of standing water on the locker room floor because there'd been a backup and the soccer players would just hop from bench to bench to avoid walking in the water. And they said it had been like that for a while, but honestly, nobody sought to do much complaining because we were just happy to be able to play.
Yeah.
And that video of the difference in the men's and women's tournament a couple of years ago said that the women are no longer happy just to play. They want to be treated the same as their brothers. And that's a huge step forward from where we were in the past. And that's what gives me hope that we will continue to move forward with the periodic bounce backs of where the 3-point line is. And I don't know, putting the poor Utah team 30 miles from the venue.
No, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, this is awful. The women's team was in the Gonzaga bracket. And so they went up to Gonzaga in Spokane, Washington to play. There wasn't enough hotel rooms for a variety of reasons. The men's bracket was there. There were a couple of other events going on. So they put them in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Coeur d'Alene, Idaho has a real race problem right now. And there were players of color on that Utah team when they were walking back and forth from their hotel to the restaurant. Pickup trucks filled with largely white men yelling racial slurs came by. And the Utah team eventually, I mean, they demanded to be moved to Gonzaga. Spokane's a little more liberal. And so they were moved. But again, it's really hard to imagine the NCAA saying to the men's, they didn't kick any of the men's teams out and say, oh, you go stay in Coeur d'Alene. And make this 30-mile drive.
Yeah, there's still work to be done to maintain the line and to push forward. You see women now in the, you know, Gatorade commercials and things like that. They're allowed to get out there and capitalize on their skills and talents and what they're worth.
I think the players should be paid by the universities as well.
These NIL deals are making college basketball for women a really good place to be. Mm-hmm. What happens when they do transition to the WNBA, which is still a second-class environment, you know, what might get lost in translation?
Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese particularly needed to make calculations is, are they better off staying in college? How many of those NIL dollars will disappear when they go to the WNBA? Clark, I think, is, I'm going to say, lucky. Hy-Vee, one of her big local sponsors in Iowa City, is expanding into Indiana. So that'll probably continue that relationship. But a player like Angel Reese, so none of them are guaranteed anything in ways that are different for the men, with larger rosters, more teams, to say nothing of a much bigger global set of options and the G League. They're just options for the men that don't exist for the women. As the number one pick, Caitlin Clark will make what, like $77,000 in salary. So if she loses NIL money, if her endorsements don't even out, maybe she's better off staying. If Angel Reese loses social media influencer money by going pro, it's very tough for WNBA rookies to have any kind of impact because they've been playing for a full year. There's no break. So physically, they've got to hit this wall. But compare that to the money men make. I'm just not sure that it's always the wisest choice. Now, the ironic part is the WNBA's rules. You got to wait 4 years from high school to go into the WNBA if you're a U.S. player, has created this phenomenon of women's basketball that we don't see with the men. We had 4 years to watch Caitlin Clark. It takes time. You get invested in players over time. Whereas the one-and-done men's programs, because they can go into the NBA after a single season, it's harder to get invested. I mean, honestly, it's harder for me to even keep track.
Right.
Now, the transfer portal for both men and women will change all of this with the motion, but at least we can still be invested in individuals in college. We'll follow the women for 4 years until the WNBA changes its rules.
Thank you to my guest, Sarah Fields, professor of communication at the University of Colorado Denver and president of the North American Society for Sport History. Music in this episode includes Spring Fling by Track Tribe and The Heist by Silent Partner. In addition to hearing news in context every Friday at 8:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m. on KSFP 102.5 in San Francisco, you can hear it on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, iHeartMedia, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Podbean, YouTube, and PRX. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at News in Context SF and on Instagram at News in Context. And you can find links to all of that at newsincontext.net. I'm Gina Valeria. Thank you for listening.